Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million. You didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell, Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 19, NASDAQ futures down 111. After a lousy day yesterday, looks like we're looking at a lousy day two here, at least so far. The Fed announcement is today. Yesterday the Dow was down 550. The transportation average was getting whomped. We've had some down days, recently, but I don't remember one like yesterday where my entire machine was red. It seemed like. I mean, everything was down. Gold, everything, silver, you name it. They didn't like anything yesterday, so. Speaking of not liking anything, do we have Mr. Kevin?
Oh, I like everything. I like everything, and I like everybody.
Well, there you go.
I am Mr. Sunshine.
Well, you know, somebody has to be. I was talking to somebody last night, and was on one of these high school boards. For those that don't know, for some reason, every single high school in Chicago, public school, has an elected board. Some parents, some students, a couple teachers. It's what they do. I'm not going to say right or wrong. And evidently there's a demonstration going to be planned for today, even though there are other activities planned. So a couple of people from the Chicago Public School came over and to give advice, and basically they had no advice. Do what you want to do. Okay, then.
What kind of demonstration are we talking about?
Pro-Palestinian, evidently. And like half the school's Jewish, so it's a mess.
Well, that's exciting. What could go wrong with that?
Yeah, and they're letting them do it inside. And, you know, I don't know why you would get people out of class to do stuff. And, of course, this gentleman who's on the board, he's like, you know, what do you do? What do you do? You know, I don't know. I go, What did Hesburgh do when everybody wanted a student strike for the Vietnam War? Didn't he?
He told him he'd give him 5 minutes to pack or 10. Maybe he was generous and gave 10.
But didn't he say if he really felt that way, he wanted to see a serious paper about your feelings and the history of the war and why you feel the way, and something along those lines?
Yeah. I think if you're going to go the educational experience route, which it sounds like what the situation you're describing is, yeah, do that. Make it, okay, let's do education. Let's get in there and let's dive in and let's do some research. Or you can just decide that the Palestinians are oppressed and therefore we must protest.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, you really don't want any, we don't want to let the facts get in the way of a good story, do we?
Well, remember, you have to go back and you start talking about things like critical race theory, which has not gone away. It's just kind of died out of the conversation. And, you know, that is all a whole model of oppressor and oppressed. And, you know, that thought process has permeated a lot of education and therefore is, this just feeds right into it. And a lot of the students don't know it, it's exactly what you're describing. They don't know the history of it, and that would probably be worth the research, but they don't know the history of it, and therefore it's just, you know, somebody's oppressed and somebody's oppressing them, and therefore that's we have to protest.
Yeah, and it's I don't know where this whole, I mean, I think people need to know a lot about history, and you know, human history has been the whole way. It's been, they got it, we want it, let's take it. I mean, and it's somewhat very rare, what you have in some places. I mean, in Greece you had peace for a while. In Rome you had peace for a while, even though they couldn't wait to go out and grab something else. But this whole post-World War II experience, this is not the norm. That's why it's so valuable. And people don't seem to get it, that how unique this whole situation is, that they actually get to protest. They actually get to do stuff like that. They actually get to be an ass if you want to be. Not saying they are. But, I mean, it is so rare. And the idea, there's always kind of winners and losers. There's people that, I'm not saying people that work, even the business world, there's people who want to work harder, people are luckier. People start with more money because parents have money. I mean, it's sort of the way it is. And what you try and do is even out the field as much as you can so that somebody else can succeed as well. I mean, you're not going to change the human situation, are you?
You're not. The thing is, you can't engineer equality. What you can do is create opportunities for people.
Yes.
Yeah. And you know, education being a big part of it, but not the only part of it. And when you do that, you just make sure that the you know, the rules are fair for everybody. Everybody gets to play by the same rules, which of course they don't. And you go from there. But you know, when you try and engineer all of this stuff, that comes with the mistaken belief that government or somebody else, some other benign entity, can take care of all of this for us. And of course, that never works. So,
I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, I always talk about, once in a while I quote my mother, because she was a very bright lady and a child of the Depression, and not a dummy, very, very, very aware of what people were doing and why at the time. And if you asked her, I mean, she would tell you about it. And it, you know, stuff like in the Depression, when she was in class, you know, in Englewood High School of all places, or grammar school, the teachers didn't expect any help from the parents at all. They taught people, you know, how to wash your face, how to cut your toenails. They taught you everything. Hygiene, everything. They never expected anybody to help with the homework or anything like that. I mean, it was a whole different world. But it was for the time. You were to bring the kids were supposed to be learning something maybe the parents didn't teach them, meaning math and English and all that other stuff, in addition to other things. And people who graduated high school back then, some of my uncles, nobody ever went to college, and yet they all ended up being, you know, tool and die makers, redrawings, could put together, you know, printing presses. I mean, and they used to all read like fiends. I mean, not that, you know, they were blue collar guys, but the idea, and you know, my mom used to say, everybody, the family has to take care of their kids. If people don't take care of their own kids, it's chaos. And now we have entire communities that don't seem to think that it's their job to take care of their kids. And somehow or another, government is supposed to make up for this. I don't see how the hell you can do that, Kevin.
So you're talking about an older model where the schools were responsible for teaching you skills, and the families were responsible for teaching the kids values. And I think it hasn't completely flipped, because the families aren't responsible for teaching skills, but the schools have decided that their primary job is to teach values. And in each case, it's a version of values that may or may not be at odds with what the family would teach.
Well, but everybody who, in this whole idea that people who are happen to be in jail are somehow or another were oppressed, and I am all for the idea, Kevin, that I would spend. It's one of those things where if you look at long term benefits versus short term, and right now virtually every governmental entity is broke. Right, we're being lied to, and we're broke. Okay, when I say being lied to, I go through sometimes the fund statements federal government has, and yet what do we discover in the last year? Just with a couple of people in the show sort of messing around, that the budget, that the the debt is growing way faster than the budget deficit would lead you to believe. So the question is, where's the rest of the money going? Nobody seems to know. Now, does anybody know? I mean, I don't know. Somebody must know someplace. And whose decision is to count one cost and not count another? But the idea that I would put money into adult education at every level, even prisons. The idea if somebody's in prison, we're going to make it as best we can. Now, if somebody's just a really bad person, there's nothing really you can do, I don't think. But if they aren't, in some sort of skill, some sort of program that when they get out, they don't come back, I think would be a very long-term positive thing. And I'm not so sure it has to cost $90 bazillion because you have to grease every community organizer and everybody else along the way to get it done. I mean, this whole concept of everything you do, your buddies have to be involved, get their thumb in there or wet their beak. You know, I don't think we can't afford that anymore. At least for a while, we got to lay off that. And the idea why these schools shut down at night when the adults need to be educated as much as the kids, you got the building right there, and you've got, I mean, in order for Chicago or any place to be anywhere that any business really wants to show up here, you need all kinds of stuff. You need location. You used to need rail. You need trucking, access to transportation. By the way, you need human capital. And human capital is people that are willing and able to learn and work. It doesn't mean that the day they show up that they're going to be a skilled welder, but they at least should know how to read a drawing, know what a welding machine is, so in 6 weeks you can make them a welder. But you can't just have your adults not knowing anything in some areas. If you expect, I mean, this is really not all that difficult, Kevin. The execution of it is going to be difficult, but the plan, where are you trying to get from here to there? It's like having a position in a stock. You sit there and go, well, here's where I'd like to be. Here's where I am. But guess what? They don't match. How do I get from A to B? We used to do that every single morning, like 50 positions when we were on the trading floor. Wait a minute. This one sucks. How do we get? Okay, if we do this spread, and then we end up in something that we like a lot better. But I mean, we got to get someplace from here, and I don't see any drive whatsoever. And you got a mayor who's going to drop the ball and talk about a stadium for 6 weeks, and then the guy doesn't. The family of the police guy who died told him not to show up anywhere near the funeral. That's heartening, isn't it?
Yeah, it's nice, well connected. You know, just a man of the people.
Yeah, and he's considered to be anti-police, and yet people think that the new police superintendent's the real deal. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's hard. How does anybody even know? You know, I can't even begin to figure out how we're going to get from how we close the gap from where we are to where maybe we ought to be. And on the federal level, I don't mean if you're running up bills twice as much as you're telling people, or almost that bad, Kevin. I don't know how the hell you cover that either. I mean, how are we gonna pay for all this stuff?
Well, that's another issue, and you know we've talked about that so much that we've just pissed away money on unproductive things that when we need it for. You know, for productive things. But, you know, even as simple as, let's say the response to the pandemic was right. You know, I know that's a big leap, but at least it is in my mind. Let's just say that was the right thing to do. And we needed to spend a lot of money to provide support. Okay, let's just go with that thought for a minute. We had been so irresponsible with the federal budget that we couldn't afford to do that. We did it, but we couldn't afford to do it. Can you imagine if we had been operating with a balanced budget all along? We've been very responsible along the way about how we spend, and now you get to that situation and you can say, okay, we're gonna have to put $1 trillion into this, and it's gonna take us 5 years to get back and to get it back, but we can do this. Instead, we just said, let's go spend $1 trillion or $2 trillion or whatever it was we spent on top of all the trillions we're spending. There's no concept of the damage that we do, not just to the current state, but the damage that we do to contingencies, to anything in the future with our current behavior. There just is that it's not, it's like with Congress, people in Congress, it's either a disconnect or they're doing it on purpose for some other reason.
They find advisors to tell them what they want to hear, Kevin, I think is what, it wasn't a great conversation, but Dr. J and I were driving to work one day before we were doing a show, but, and all of a sudden they were talking about the Illinois, had like a budget deficit. This might have been Begoy, but some of those guys was a governor. And I go, John, what's wrong with this picture? And he goes, what do you mean? And I said, well, the economy, this might have been maybe, I don't know, it was late 80s or early 90s, you know, kind of when the economy was doing pretty good. And I said, you know, the state, In our the last 20 years, has the state ever been in as good a shape as it is now? He says, no. And I said, well, how is it we still have a deficit? I mean, it's not going to get any better. Wouldn't you think that right now we would be running at least flat, maybe even a little surplus? Because
yeah, let's sock it away for a rainy day.
Yeah, the only place we could go from here is down. And how do you even? But then you have advisors that tell you, and this is, When Trump did the tax cuts, he went to the Congressional Budget Office, and somehow in his mind, or in the mind of people around him, whether they all knew it was BS at the time, I don't know. Maybe I'm not accusing them of that. They had people to tell him this was actually going to be accretive. When George Bush II put the Iraq War basically on a credit card, he underestimated how much the war was going to cost going forward with people, arms and legs, and to get it, and taking care of people and stuff. I read an article at the time that said this is going to cost us over the next 30 years taking care of wounded and stuff, it's going to cost us $1.5 trillion. Well, the budget, their estimate was like what, a couple hundred billion? I mean, it wasn't even on the same planet. So, and then you have people that say, don't worry, just as long as you're never going to pay the debt down, as long as the economy is growing by, you know, a smidge, is that a lot? A smidge more than the debt.
Eventually, that's one of those economics technical.
Yeah, you'll eventually catch up. And that's fine, okay? It's hard to argue with that, that if your debt's going to grow by 3% a year and your economy's going to grow by 5%, if you extend it out, you're going to be okay. There's no way you can argue with the math. The problem is, whose estimates are you using? If you continually screw up the estimates where your growth really isn't 5%, it's 2%, and oh, by the way, your expenses really aren't growing by 3%, they're growing by 5%. Now all of a sudden you got a real problem, right? And they listen to people they sort of want to listen to. And the people who get the job around them are people Russell actually sent a letter to the Trump administration asking for a job. And Russell's a brilliant man. They want to know part of him. What, he was gonna say, your math's wrong, and they were afraid of that, or what? I mean, you believe who you want to believe, and then you say, all I got to do is make it through 4 years, I'll fix it next term, or whatever these guys' mentality is, or they don't even look at the numbers. It's something that for a long period of time, it's almost like if you have a little dog and he misbehaves, it's kind of cute. If you got a big dog and he misbehaves, it's not cute anymore, right?
I don't know. Ask Christy Noem.
Yeah. God. People on farms are used to dealing with animals different than people who have them as pets.
No, I absolutely know that's you know, what she described was not unusual for farm people, but it's not going to fly with a whole lot of people. So, why would you put that in a book? I don't.
Let's put it this way. It's gonna test Audrey's Republican leanings, because Audrey is kind of a cross between Wrangler Jane and Ellie Mae in a lot of ways. She loves her animals, and which makes her terrific, I think. But we're talking about the lady who, Audrey's the one who saved the goose that got whacked by the car, brought him home and nursed him back to health, and then he flew away. But, so the thought of blasting something, I don't think that would be in her wheelhouse.
Not going to fly. And I think, you know, there's a lot to, policy wise, there's a lot to like about Christy Noem. So. It ain't happening now. If she was ever going to be on any kind of list for vice president, she's off it. So.
Well, I mean, I think you have this whole concept of who is going to, quote, run the place. Now, you know, we can, I think, generally agree that probably if we really looked, we could find a couple of better candidates than we got going. That's as far as I'll go with that. Whichever one.
You think?
Yeah, well, I mean, the other day they were talking about the polls, you know, and how they're even and this, that, and the other thing. And the guy was doing the polling said, it really is who you like least. You're voting against.
Wasn't it the same thing last time?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure it was. I think it probably was with Trump and Hillary.
Yeah.
But now I'm not exactly sure, Kevin, with all the, you know, talking we do on the show and the really smart people we have on here and the listeners that write in and help us out, I'm not so sure if the five of us that are the key people of the show got dropped in the Oval Office tomorrow, we'd be pretty hard-pressed into putting a list up there. Let's start here. Here's number two. Here's number three. I mean, it would be tough. It'd be real tough. You've got a market. I've been talking lately. I mean, I'm not usually a market timer. I'm not at all. But I've sort of seen this movie before, kind of in reverse. All I'm saying is if the deficit continues to run away, and this long-term rate makes it to 5, 6, 7, and it's been creeping up all week, the 10-year. If we're going to 7 or 8, I'd be really surprised. Not that it couldn't happen, that the market isn't appreciably lower than it is now. And I hope that doesn't happen. And if it happens, I would like to see some people protected somewhat, especially if they're not working and they're retired or whatever. Kevin, you can't. Nobody wants to hear that. What do you mean? It's just going to be like the last 10 years. The worst message you could ever give to a stock market was the COVID situation. Kevin, the country shut down and the market went straight up because of the money they poured into the place. So I have articles here that I've read and where say, don't worry about a recession. The market's going to go straight up through the recession. The Fed's going to pour money in. Well, now the Fed's got problems. Because we're talking, what, a third of our total, let me find it. But what's our total spending per year? It's like $1 trillion, right, or something, or $1.5 trillion, let me find it. And our debt, if we start talking, what, 7% on $32 trillion, what are we talking, 200 and some billion a year just in interest? I mean, no matter what, you got to pay that, right?
And then somebody's going to say, well, we need to be at least responsible enough to cut elsewhere so that we can afford to pay that.
Yeah, that's...
And they'll get accused of being, heartless people who are depriving others of important services that they need to live their lives.
The federal spending actual is $6.7 trillion. All right, so if you take 7% of $34 trillion, you're talking what? 10% would be 3.4, so 7 is what? 2.6 or something? So we're talking roughly a third, 6.7 total spending, and 2.6 is going to be interest. Kevin, that crap doesn't fly. I mean, that's way too much.
And I maxed out my credit card, and I'm paying 24%.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Well, you can go BK if you want it. It's pretty tough.
That's true. I suppose the United States could, too. It's called default.
Well, I think some cities... We had this discussion last night, and I got to talk about both sides of your mouth. You never met him. He died when I was 4. My dad was a policeman. I have nothing but the warmest feelings. I have police plates on my car. Nobody's a bigger supporter. Yet I know from the money side of it, the police chief came out a few weeks ago and talked about how young the force is, how many people have retired during COVID and lately. Kevin, you can't be paying these guys at 55. They cannot be a policeman in today's world, and I surely understand that. But there has to be some. They have to be in behind the scenes detective work. They have to be in evidence gathering. They have to be doing something. The math doesn't work. Or if somebody lives to 100, you pay them 65 years for working 20. You can't do that. I mean, the other people just don't have the dough. It's not whether they deserve it, not deserve it. It's just not there. I mean, I think. Everybody I know deserves to make $1 million a year, but from where, right? I mean, it's got to come from someplace. It's not a question of deserving. You know, it's like, what, in California, You can retire. Is it 20 years? I'm not positive. 20 years if you're a prison guard or something? I wouldn't want that job. Do you deserve it? Probably. Can we pay it? No. Right? It's a different conversation, isn't it? It doesn't come down to how bad the job is or anything like that. It's just, if somebody gets a job when they're 25, they retire at 45, and they live to be 100, which people are doing. Actually, people are dying less lately, but let's say by the time they're old enough, everybody lives to be 100. Can you really pay somebody for 75 years for 20 years' work? I don't see how that dog hunts, do you?
No, I mean, would it not be more, frankly, honest, but also more expedient to just pay a hell of a lot more if that's what you need to do? Because all you're really doing is deferring compensation by doing that. And when you do that, you're just kicking the can down the road as opposed to pay it in current dollars. And if you're paying twice the salary because, you know, you're replacing the incentive of the long-term pension starting at a very young age, and you're replacing that with salary, then pay it, and then at least you know what you're spending, and you're not just deferring some liability that is in all likelihood not funded. So, would that not make more sense?
Well, sure it would, but nobody want that. But the truth? Would anybody want the truth?
I guess not.
Well, I mean,
why don't people in government want it? Is because we talked about cost and accrual before, because they want to just run on a cash basis, and if they run on a cash basis, the less they spend now, the better it is for me. The better it makes me look.
Well, yeah, and I think for those that don't know, and if you don't live in Hawaii, why would you? And maybe you don't want to. But the idea of pensions here, we actually have, is it every 10 or 20 years, Kevin, we do a, there's a vote whether to have another constitutional convention. Maybe it's 50, I don't know what it is, but it's in the Constitution. When you and I were in high school, there was a constitutional convention. I don't know how the hell they did that, but they... Illinois had one, and the people who went to the convention could not have held office anywhere. It had to be all new people. And that's where this whole generation of people older than us, the Richie Daley, I think Madigan, Marty Russo, all those guys were young guys in their 20s and 30s that ran for the convention. And you got used to, you know, having your name on a sign in somebody's yard. And a lot of those guys just piled right into politics, especially the lawyers and so forth. But the reason why everybody votes this down is every union is against it. And anybody who's ever worked for the state is against it. Because in the Constitution is a clause that says you can never, is it decrease or do something, I forget what the word is. You can't...
in any way impair the pension system.
You can't decrease anybody's pension. The idea being is that you couldn't threaten judges if they don't vote your way that you're going to decrease their pension and so forth, and that's fine. I don't really have an issue with that, but it's evolved into any dirty trick that you pull, they can never reverse it. So the Illinois system, as crazy as this is, and as much as you want to badmouth Chicago, the fact is Chicago is the only municipality in the state that has its own pension system. I think it's the only one. I'm not positive. Maybe St. Louis does, but where everybody else, like if you're in Evergreen Park, where I grew up, all the money for the pension goes down to the state, and the state handles it. So if you're Evergreen Park principal of high school, I'm not saying they did it, but a lot of places did. If you're supposed to get 80% of your salary when you retire, and you play some game where you take like all your sick leave your last year, or you get overtime, or you get a bonus or something, so your salary is 100 grand, all of a sudden the last year you make 200, you're going to get 170 grand a year in pension, right? Which you never friggin' deserved at all. But now the state pays it, Evergreen Park doesn't, so they don't really care. But this is building up. So I'm not so sure that if I'm governor, I can't sit there and go, I want everybody's actual salary the last year they worked. and I'm cutting their pension down to 85% of that. And if they don't like it, sue me. You know, and see what happens, Kevin. I don't know that if you played some game, that the game is held is covered by the Constitution. Do you? I mean, the best was my brother Dan knows knew of a lady. I think it was, I don't know, some southern, some might have been Blue Island, might have been one of those places. And she's in the she's a librarian. Been there forever, and of course she's getting raises all the time, and she's making a nice salary. Well, they decide she's making too much, whatever town this was. So they force her into retirement. Okay, now the retirement means that now the state's paying her and not the suburb. So now they can hire some young lady for less of a salary, or a guy. I mean, they happen to hire a lady for way less of a salary. So now on Blue Island's books, or whatever town it was, they just cut costs. Yet on the state books, you're in my books, we're now paying two people. But it gets better. The lady they hire is of younger age. Guess what? She's pregnant. Has a baby. And now she's off for, you know, God knows how long, 6 months or whatever, amazingly, you know.
But she's on leave. So
she's
yeah.
And she's on leave. And I think she gets paid or something in Illinois. So, plus she's got, you know, vacation backed up the whole bit. So she's gone for quite a while. So guess in your wildest dreams what they do, because now they're short on a librarian.
Oh, I don't even have to guess. I'm sure they just hired back the older one. Yeah. As a 1099 employee. And,
yeah.
So they're paying her probably more than they ever paid her before.
And now they've got three people in the same job, but Blue Island's happy. I'm like, you know, what? This kind of stuff, it sounds cute when somebody does it. And if it's your grandfather, all of a sudden is making more of his than he ever made as a job in retirement, you sit there and go, yeah, he deserves it. He worked his whole life as a principal, and he was underpaid, and he's a brilliant man, and blah, blah, blah. You can go that route, but when you start multiplying it hundreds and hundreds of times, and other people are paying for it that don't even have a pension, it starts to get old.
It's an expensive way to do business.
Yeah, but their point is, other people, but if you're in that position, I mean, we had the head of the pensions of the Chicago Teachers Union on the show one day. As far as they're concerned, a promise is a promise, and the other people just got to pony up, even if they don't even know what a pension is. It's a different view of the world, Kevin. It really is. And somehow it has to get broken, but I don't want to be the guy to do it. I mean, let's say I want to do is hold office or anybody, and the first thing you do is start ripping this crap down. You know it has to be ripped down, but I don't want to do it. You know, I don't want people shooting at me, not literally or figuratively. I mean, it's an ugly job. You know, it's like wandering into a school that's totally undisciplined. I mean, you didn't get it there, and turning it back the other way is an ugly job, right? Assuming you can even do it.
Doing any kind of turnaround is an ugly job. It's really hard, and it takes a long time.
Yet there are obviously serious pockets of some areas that are seemingly be doing it right, and obviously, on the show, you're the guy that says if you work hard enough in these areas, people are still pretty damn good and are willing to do some stuff. And if the opportunity is there, at least some of them will pile up and take the sword and go. And yet I had my brother has, you know, dinner every Sunday. It's almost like the guys on NY, what is it, the Blue Bloods or something. And my nephew's wife, terrific lady, she's a math teacher. And every week I talk to her about, you know, what the story is with people behind. And I also had the same conversation with my mother's cousin in Columbus, who's a retired math teacher, but now is working after school at like three different schools to try and get people caught up, and says there's no way. Well, this young lady says to me, there's no accountability for how far these kids are behind. And she says, it's not just in math, this COVID thing. She goes, we have one kid that he must have been downstairs in his room for 2.5 years. Parents didn't even like talk to him. The kid can barely walk. He's got a wheelchair. He never was let out because he was afraid they were going to get COVID. I mean, she says it's not just math. Everybody's a year and a half in any kind of education. They can't talk to each other. They don't do any sports. It's the damage is dramatic, and there's no assessment of it. tour, say, okay, we're going to, instead of one recess a day, we're going to do two or something because these kids need some help. There's no even mea culpa, not that it's anybody's fault. It says, look, we need to do something different for next few years. The term catching up is probably bad. You're never going to, quote, catch up, but we have to figure out where exactly is everybody. Maybe we should drop the phones for a while and make sure kids go to library without the phone. Something, Kevin. I don't know. I'm not close enough to it, but it seems like with these anecdotal stories you hear from people, they're horrible. Just saying.
Well, yeah, they are. And when you say there's no accountability, yeah, it's like all of that overreaction is in the rearview mirror now.
Except the damages aren't.
You know, for a little while, people were asking for forgiveness. They were sort of, you know, that you had people out there saying, "Well, we didn't know what we didn't know, and therefore, you know, we did our best, and I hope, you know, we know a lot of it was mistakes." Now, we don't even have that. Everybody's just counting on the collective memory to be gone, and you know, we're coming into an election season. That should be a big discussion item.
Oh, we're talking about two people can't. Could either one of these guys write an op-ed every Sunday for
totally complicit?
But I mean, could either one of them, if you gave them a five subjects, that the next five Sundays, we give them a week to do it, could actually write them, not have somebody do it, write a column that goes on every Sunday newspaper around the country that says, okay, this is how I'm going to deal with this, I'm going to deal with this, I'm going to deal with this. I don't think either one of these people are even capable.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, I don't. Look, I question Biden's capabilities to do anything at the moment. But for different reasons, for health reasons. Are they otherwise capable? Yeah, they should have been capable all along.
I can't think of
a reason why they weren't.
Well, I would think that just because he was there.
They're not stupid people in their way. You know, it's just, you know, their skill sets may not be to your liking, but and their demeanors may not be to their liking. But hell, you know, Biden managed to run a corrupt family enterprise for a long time.
Well,
made a hell of a lot of money.
I'm sure with you on the skill set.
He's pretty good at that.
Actually, Kevin, before we dig further into this, speaking of what we were just saying about stuff that happens in arrears, at 7 o'clock, we're going to have a terrific guest, and John Flanagan will be on with us because he's the best guy to help you with interview guests. A lady named Diane Kelly, a friend of Audrey's and a friend of mine, a very talented lady. She's in a previous life, Kevin, she's a sommelier. Imagine that. She never forgets to keep her pinky up when she's drinking her wine, but she's an absolute worldwide expert on wine, and she retired. But she's been doing work for this group I had mentioned before that does, they're doing like Ronald McDonald houses, for lack of a better term, for people that bring family members to the veterans hospitals. You know, you come here and maybe you get a new prosthesis or something, takes you a week or two to learn how to walk or whatever. I mean, you know, that's probably way more complicated than that. These are people from the Iraq, from the Afghanistan, from all these places that everybody else has forgotten about, right, Kevin? I mean, this is in the wake are all these bodies or half bodies or something or people you have to take care of. And she decided when she retired, she's going to take over this place. They offered her the job, and they just broke ground at a place up. I'll let her tell the whole story up near Great Lakes for a new facility. They have one here in the West Side, but now this new place is built, and they're, you know, of course they have some budget from the government, but they're, you know, obviously looking for a little more dough to make it nicer. And you know what? There's people that actually do care. There's people that are covering the tracks of the people that maybe should have realized if once we went into Afghanistan, this was going to be the problem. And what are we going to do about all these people? And by the way, are we going to budget for taking care of them? And the answer is no. Right? I mean, you can't, over a long period of time, a country like ours deserves more competence at the top level, or truth. I mean, I think we do. I hope we don't go under, because I don't know where. I sure as hell don't want to be like these other countries in the world. But I'm not so sure the way we're handling ourselves, we don't go under, Kevin. And I really don't want that to happen. Just saying.
Well, I'm not arguing with you. I, I think we're screwing ourselves.
I mean, how long can we go sending out this incredibly detailed budget statement every month, and you look at it, and guys like me, they're dummies, are looking at it, and they you know, go through the numbers, and guys like Carl talk about the how much is Medicare, how much is this, and how much is this growing, and the other. Then you look at the debt, and the debt's growing twice as fast, and you go, wait a minute, who's on the second payroll that we don't know about? I find it stunning, don't you?
I think it's actually kind of awesome.
Yeah, if you can pull that off.
Awesome, and it's in the corruption.
When we have, now we talked a little bit, we got a few minutes, Kevin, before Diane comes on. Let's talk a little bit about some of the universities that are having budget problems.
There were some additional closures announced this week.
Now, what is it? For some reason, you talked about Valpo. Now, I always wish maybe one part of me says maybe I should have gone to Valpo because of a great meteorological school. And every one of the ladies who's a weather girl is awesome, aren't they?
Yeah.
We could have dated one of those girls.
To give you a feeling for its reputation, it has consistently been ranked in the top two or three of Midwestern regional universities when U.S. News and World Report puts out its rankings. So is U.S. News and World Report the definitive statement on a college? I would say no, although colleges pay a whole lot of attention to it. But it's one that's out there that's very popular and has a big following. So the point being that Valparaiso's reputation as an educational institution is very top notch, and it's a private school, Lutheran, I believe, but I can't swear to that. That's to be known, and they're struggling. Now, the question is, why are they struggling? Everybody's struggling with enrollment for a couple of reasons. One, and don't diminish this, is that all these colleges, mine included, told people to stay home for 2 years. We taught people not to come to school. And even if we were doing our classes via Zoom, people were falling by the wayside in that mode. And so it is a very, very challenging prospect to bring people back and to get people back into the mindset of coming to school and learning things. That's hurt every college, their own decisions, they're responsible for that. But in addition, it is the cost of a college education now that is turning people away. There's just not a value proposition for it anymore.
Well, Kevin, back up, I'm sorry to interrupt, but back up a hair though. I agree with you on the collective we told people not to come to school, but would it have been possible, we still remember those couple of years, would have been possible for Ivy Tech or Valpo or Notre Dame to say, we don't believe any of this crap, we're open? I don't see how it could have been.
I think there are a few schools out there that did, and I'd have to check them out and see. You know, that's a little bit of a research item for me to be able to cite examples.
Still, it would seem like... I can only imagine you don't care if people...
Some of the Florida schools.
I can only imagine somebody, you don't care if people die. I mean, the immediate garbage you would have thrown at you would have been more than most people would have wanted to absorb.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people that, it isn't what they think is right or wrong. It's they just don't want the garbage. They don't want to be ducking the garbage thrown at them.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I had students nonstop. I'd get them talking to me during that time and saying, are we going to get to come back to campus next semester? And, I'd say, don't know, decision's not made. Then the decision's made, no, we're going to defer again. And every round, we lost students. Enrollment was likely to be down anyway for other reasons, which I will cite again in a second. But on top of that, this is part of the reason enrollment is down. And now, so you now you have to re-engage with prospect students to try and come up with ways to get them to come back. Okay, that's a big marketing effort. Because remember, Tom, you know, what's the cheapest marketing dollar you have? The most expensive marketing dollar is getting a new customer. The cheapest marketing dollar you spend is providing good service to your customers and getting them to come back and do more business with you. So at the minute we drive them away, all of a sudden now the cost and the effort to get people to come back is a big deal, whereas just working on keeping them here was completely different. Okay, so we stipulate that.
Do you think how much of that, Kevin, is and this is, I'll ask you because I probably have an opinion that's unfounded in fact. How much of the world's, now you guys don't charge a lot, so maybe you're feeling that there's reasons that are different, but somebody piles out of high school, maybe he's even enrolled someplace, and all of a sudden he's home for 2 years. Some places did stuff remotely. Some maybe just said, I'll wait a year or something. I don't want to pay that kind of money for remote or whatever it was. And all of a sudden it's 3 years later, and Joe or Judy's been in the basement doing God knows what. And, because you really couldn't go find another job if you wanted to. I mean, you could have done something, I guess, but you really would have had a... Now, all of a sudden, maybe the family didn't do so well during COVID either. And by the way, prices are a hell of a lot higher. And now all of a sudden, Ma and Pop and Joe or Judy look at the 50, 60, 70, 30 grand and go, I don't know, we thought we could afford that 3 years ago. That's not happening. How much of it is an economic shock three years later?
Or people who saved a lot, how much did we cut into those savings?
Yeah, I'm saying so.
I mean, different variation on the same thought.
I would have to say that the average disposable cash for a family during that 3 years had to go down, unless you were, maybe if you owned a business and you got the PPP stuff. Some people did well, but most people, I have to believe, didn't do as well. I'm going to say that some people maybe dipped into the college savings. Some of it I'm saying is economic. A lot of it is what you're describing.
That's where I was going to go next, though, is there is the economic angle for it, that, people have become wise to to college debt.
Yeah.
And what it costs, and it's gotten a lot of publicity, it's gotten a lot of attention, and even if they bail a whole bunch of people out here, that doesn't mean that going forward people can expect to be bailed out of their student loans. So we have that to deal with too.
Yeah, I mean in some schools I think the overhead's too high. Some of that's their fault when things were fat and happy, everyone's getting a loan. When I looked at the University of California, I should do this again because I keep spouting it out there. But the last time I looked, I think they had 10 indirect employees for every teacher, every professor. Now, I'm not counting adjunct, whatever. I mean, some of the people that are employees, research students, they actually teach a class too, so it's probably a sloppy number, but it's pretty outrageous, Kevin. I mean, it's not like it's I keep going back to talk about a bygone era. When I went to grammar school at St. John Fisher, a lot of Irish people that were pretty good at one thing. We got a lot of kids in the neighborhood, and we had four classes of 40 to 43 kids per class every grade, and two kindergartens. And this is in a square mile, part of which was a golf course. So there's a lot of kids. I don't know if that was your experience up north, but we had. So what is that, 32 teachers in the regular grades, some of them were nuns, two kindergarten teachers, so you're talking 34. They had, I think, two janitors, one music teacher, a principal, and an assistant. So you had five indirect employees for 34 direct. And if somebody called in sick, the principal taught class. Okay, and you never had more than one person calling. It doesn't matter if people were dying, it showed up. That's a little different than today's world, wouldn't you say? I got to believe the Chicago Public Schools have way more employees than they have teachers. It's got to be way better and worse than one-to-one, isn't it?
I would guess so, yeah.
When the difference is dramatic. You know, I mean, I don't know how you cut it any differently. I mean, we
make a bureaucracy. I can't even say the word bureaucracy go away.
Yeah,
make one go away. Go ahead, try and do that.
Oh yeah, you're it's impossible. I mean, I can't even imagine what the Chicago public schools is like. But it's probably not as bad as a major university. I mean, you said it at Notre Dame now. I mean, there's a press person for lacrosse, for God's sake. I mean, there's how many people are in the athletic department? The more money you get, the more people you hire.
Oh, and look at any athletic department's organization chart. They generally get published. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And why is it that way? It's just because the money comes in. The people don't run lean unless they get forced to run lean. So, so what happens is when there's a whole lot of money floating around, we spend it. And that's how it goes, especially if you're in, in the university world. And then when there's not money, then you have to start doing cuts. But now, you're dealing with sacred cows and, all kinds of other stuff that come into play. And so now you have to deal with all that. Well, a lot of these schools and big name type of schools are starting to recognize that the status quo isn't working for them because they're not getting the enrollment anymore. Now, the other dynamic that's part of that, Tom, is that you have a lot of people who are saying, you know what, I'd be better off learning a trade. I'll make more money than a lot of college graduates. And in addition to that, I don't need to have, to go to college, spend all that money, get debt, accumulate the debt that goes with it. And instead, what they're doing is, they're getting specific skills training rather than traditional college degrees.
And I'm always on the side on that one that colleges ought to be priced in such a way where it's not an either-or decision.
Well, and I agree with you, Tom, and it doesn't have to be because I think there's a lot of personal enrichment that you can do and that would make a lot of sense. But ultimately, the point is part of the reason most people go to college is for their economic benefit. Not as much for personal.
Well,
personal enrichment, and if you can't make the economic case for it, then people eventually turn rational.
I would say that when we were in school, and it was ways back. I bet we could even check it out. Somebody might know. I'm going to say that at Notre Dame, the arts and letters school was over half the students, and business and engineering was probably 40%. But I could be wrong there. But the school was not considered necessarily a vocational school, and now they sort of are. If you're not doing engineering, you're not doing accounting, you got no business there, right? But we got a dash here, Kevin.
Accounting, IT, business, yeah.
Yeah, you got no business here. And Kevin, we'll talk more about this on Friday. We have to get John and Diane on here. S&P futures down 20, NASDAQ futures down 113. Just as a way of review real quick, yesterday it was about as bad a day as we've seen in a long time. Dow was 570, S&P down 80, NASDAQ down 325, over 2% on the NASDAQ. Transportation average got clobbered, it was down 2%. I don't normally talk about that one. We'll be right back with Mr. John Flanagan and Diane Kelly.
Who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Something happening here. Blowing up Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 22. NASDAQ Futures down 117. That wouldn't be so bad, except we were down horribly yesterday, and I was kind of hoping for a bounce. Right now, we're not getting it. Now, we have the Fed announcement today and a news conference this afternoon. So he better be coming up with something here that the people like to hear. Do we have Mr. Flanagan and Miss Diane Kelly?
I'm with you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, well, now we can. Andrew just fixed it. You're on with me and John Flanagan. John helps me out on when I have really good interviews. John helps out. So, and you're a good interview. Hey, how are you? How's this beautiful day? Things good?
I'm well, thank you. Happy May Day.
Yeah, happy May Day. Are you? What are we going to do for May Day? Nothing. I mean, we have celebrate. We're going to have a big. Are we going to go over to Russia?
I'm on my way to meet my treasurer to go over our budgets and our finances.
Oh, God.
So that's my day.
Well, you know, somebody has to do it. Diane is on to talk about Fisher House, where she is now officially the president of. Diane, where would you like to start? I mean, I already sort of prepped everybody and what the group does. Where do you want to start with how you got started? You want to start with who Fisher is, or you want to start with what you guys do? Why don't you start with what you do?
How about if I start about what Fisher House is,
because okay.
I know you have given some information out, but most people, unless you're really a military family, and even people at Heinz VA Hospital, they don't even know. I've heard about Fisher House, but they're not really sure what it is. So it's the Ronald McDonald Home for military families. And that's really the best way to describe it. But in 1990, Zachary and Elizabeth Fisher gave a gift of $20 million to create these homes for military families. Zachary grew up in New York and comes from a very well-to-do construction family. Wanted to go and support during World War II, but was not able to because of his health issues. But realized that after World War II, there was so much trauma with families and medical issues with military families. So they invested some money and started the first home at Rockville, Maryland, outside of Annapolis. And it kind of just grew from there. So there are 34 states that have Fisher homes in them. The really good news that I'm trying to get everybody aware that Illinois has become the 100th home for the Fisher House Foundation that we're opening up. We just did the groundbreaking at Great Lakes Naval Base. So we are the official 100th home for Fisher House Foundation, which is a huge, big deal for us.
Dan, obviously there's a veterans hospital associated with every one of these places. If you build next to the hospital, I guess, it's a simpleton answer question.
Correct, yes. Where there's a military base, there's usually a hospital and a Fisher House. So we have a Fisher home in Germany and a Fisher House in the United Kingdom as well. So we just broke ground at Great Lakes Naval Base, which is on Buckley Road. It's should be open by November, December of this year. It's a 16-room home. The Fisher House that is at Heinz VA, we just celebrated our 14 years up and running. And to give people an idea of the cost, at the time when that home was open, it was a $7.5 million home, 21 rooms. This Lovell House is going to be a $10 million home. You have to kind of think about a Fisher House being, think about the best hotel that you've stayed at. And this is like the best hotel, but it's also like your home. If you have nights where you can't sleep because your loved one's in the hospital, you don't know what's going on, you can go downstairs, have a cup of tea, have some hot chocolate, cookies, warm cookies, put your head on a really nice bed and stay there for as long as you need. We've had people stay for 18 months because of somebody having treatment. So we are there 24/7, 365 days of the year with no cost to anyone except that you take care of your loved one and we fit the bill.
So we're not talking about, a huge apartment building. We're talking about people that actually have, in all these hospitals, these are like rehab facilities, or most of the time people doing rehab are getting new arms and legs, or what is there a typical patient or family?
Yes. I mean, I've seen families. I did an Easter dinner for Heinz this year, and this family has been, six families were there. And this one particular lady was telling me about her husband, and he's in the PV, the paralyzed veterans area. He's a quadriplegic, and he's in the hospital. She was there for a week. And then I was just there to stop by, and I saw her again. And I said, oh my gosh, you're back already. She goes, yeah. She goes, he's not doing well. So she's back, and she said, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate this home because it makes it so much easier. They are in Indiana. And
She takes the guy home, who helps her take care of him there?
She's going to have to put him in a facility, and because she can no longer take care of him. So right now he's back and forth at Heinz getting treatments and trying to be well enough to go into a facility. But we have a lot of patients that are, a lot of Iraq patients, younger folks that getting arms and legs fitted. We, the cancer ward, cancer treatments, with the blind center, where they're getting, work for blind patients. So, Heinz has a lot of people coming in and out of there. In 2023, we hosted over 14,000 families. Over 28 individuals were served.
You've hosted 14,000 families with 20-some rooms? Wow.
Yeah. So, and here's the other level that we have to work on. If Heinz is filled, or these Fisher homes are filled, and someone needs a place to stay, we find local hotel rooms that we've worked with to take care of them. We do not turn anyone away. So that's another part of my budget that I have to try to allocate for. Last year we spent over $5,000 on just hotel rooms covering.
And that's getting a break from people, probably.
Yes. So, I'm just trying to get the word out. We need donations, and we're just looking for, I'm working on setting up an endowment fund, for Fisher House, Illinois, and, it takes about $107,000 a year to maintain these homes. I also have a grant person that I work with to get grants. So, we're just, every dollar helps.
Diane, what's the connection between this the two houses and a house in New York? Is there an organization on top with some big endowment, or how does the money work? Or are you on your own?
We are on our own. the Fisher House, so let me explain, the Fisher House Foundation, which is part of Elizabeth and Zachary Fisher that created the foundation, they are the big umbrella over. So their job is to go in when a military area or a state requests a Fisher House. And so they go in, they work with the VA. In the case of Lovell, it was the DOG, the Navy, and the VA working because the space is multiple. So they go in, they build the home, they put everything together, they turn the keys over to the VA, and the VA run it. All the employees that run Fisher Houses are from the Veterans Affairs Association, or the VA.
But you're not. No.
We are a 501(c) for the state of Illinois. We are the non-for-profit organization that funds these homes. Our job is to maintain them, keep them running, take care of them, take care of the families that are in need on whatever the home is required. So that's food. We pay for cleaning supplies. We built a shed because there was no shed for storage. We give the families, you know, a dinner out. If they've been there for, you know, more than 3 or 4 weeks, they're pretty exhausted. And so we give them a night out for dinner. We take, you know, or go to a movie or go to a show. If somebody comes up from a warm state in Illinois and it ends up being really cold, or they need jackets, clothing, we buy that for them. So it's kind of that, just, you know, watching over them, maintaining, taking care of them.
So there's 34 state groups like you, in addition to the overwhelming top.
The people.
Jan, do you have any questions? I'm doing all the talking.
Well, I'm absolutely fascinated, Diane, by what you're telling us. It reminds me, you know, when I was very young, my uncle was a quadriplegic. He had a spinal injury, not in the war, just shortly before I was born, but he used to go to Heinz for his therapy, and my brother and my dad and I would accompany him, you know, a couple times a week to go to Heinz, and we would walk through the hospital when my uncle was having therapy. He was just an outpatient there, but I remember talking over the experience of just looking at the patients there and the loneliness I felt in the place. And my mother and dad both told me, you know, the saddest thing about, it's a great place, but, you know, the saddest thing is some of those people never have any visitors. They don't ever see any of their loved ones. It's not that they're forgotten, but there's just no way people are going to make the journey to come and see them. And I always thought that was about the toughest thing if you had to be a patient there. So I marvel that you supply this kind of need, because it's such an important part of the healing process for the patient, let alone therapeutic for the family. So I applaud what you're doing.
You know, John, you are exactly the type of person that we want to get involved with Fisher House, because you've been there, you've seen this firsthand, and you are so right. You know, a lot of the patients that come to Heinz, you know, they were in the military, but they've had injuries or illnesses outside of war duty. And so now they go to Heinz for their care. And it, you know, a lot of it is so far for them to travel. And so anyone outside of a 50-mile radius, we will support. Over 50 miles, it's too far to drive back and forth, and it makes it so much easier for a loved one. And that is our motto, that, you know, a family's love is the best medicine. And I also volunteer there at Heinz VA. I'm part of chaplain services, and I'm part of, you know, where no soldier dies alone. It is the most rewarding, sad aspect of seeing this, but I am so grateful that I have been there with the family and giving them communion and supporting them. And just, I can't even tell you what the families, how they just react for you being there, because maybe they weren't there when their loved one passed. But it's just, it is probably one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my life. And I'm so grateful that I was given the opportunity to do this. And I just, you know, I thank you for your time and giving me a voice to get the word out that we need more volunteers, more supporters. And it's just, it's a really, really rewarding, inspirational.
Well, Diane, it seems like we'll let you go. I know you're, but we'll give a couple. I always have questions. Plus, people like you, whenever you say something, it brings you to more questions because it's even more interesting. So it seems in the phenomenon in the last few wars, oh God, I can't believe I just said that, but that a lot of the people that go overseas and get shot up, basically, are from a lot of smaller towns. You didn't really have the participation from the bigger cities, which is not important. But so you're talking about a real lot of people might be from the guys in the National Guard, like Danville or something, and then people come home and two or three guys are shot up, or girls, and now they're a long way from a veteran's home, and you're like the closest place, like maybe St. Louis or maybe here, and all of a sudden now the family is a long way. It's not like these people are all from Chicago, right?
Oh, no, and to that point, Tom, it's very interesting. So if you take our country and you take an upside T, you go the T from the Midwest down to the Southern Belt, that's who is in our military.
Yeah.
That covers our military. So, and you are absolutely right. That is totally, so we, you know, Texas has a burn unit. So every area sort of has their specialty. And so sometimes, depending on the need, they will go to a different area. Now, the paralyzed veterans, because of, you know, Iraq war, a lot of injury, of spinal cord injury and missing limbs. We have a lot of that at Hines. And the other area that is very, very disturbing for me is that we need help with is the PTSD and the mental issues that they come back with. It is so sad. I mean, the military of suicide is almost right there with, you know, first responder workers and police officers. It's so sad. They need help and support. And so we're working on that too.
Does the new place have a, Are you shooting for a specialty there, or just getting open for general and then maybe move to a specialty?
Well, we are just the housing. The level has the medical. Those are where the specialty areas lie.
Okay.
So level is a medical center, and they do have counseling and specialty. And so does Hines. You know, they have social workers that work with them.
But they're not like a burn unit. I mean, they're not one of those kind of specialty.
Oh no. So Lovell will stay as a full-fledged medical facility with special areas, but nothing to the point where we'll be, it may grow, but right now it's more of a medical facility. Because what you have to remember is that a lot of especially like Hines, it's more of veterans, whereas Lovell is active duty and families. So now that's a whole nother level of patient and care when you have active duty people coming to the facility. So an active duty person that's at Lovell, his family may be in Florida, or his family may be in Georgia or North Carolina. And if something happens to him and he's in the hospital or whatever, his family has to come up and take care of him. And so that's where the Lovell house will be.
Okay, so the people in there are people that might have gotten hurt and are still in the Army or the Navy or something.
Correct.
It's man, this is fascinating. We're gonna put up send us a link, and we'll obviously get it up on the site and so forth. But
I'll send you the website.
Yeah.
This is the best place to go. It has everything. It has the board. It tells everything about Fisher House, and it's www.fofhil.org. We are Friends of Fisher House, Illinois.
We'll tweet that out too to everybody, because we got a big bunch of people on the. When am I going to see you on a personal level? Soon?
Yes.
I don't know. I think you ladies are avoiding me, I think.
What?
Well, Audrey always tells me, hey, I met with everybody last night. I go, that's great. I'm here tonight. But I don't know, Jan, I'm getting a complex. What can I tell you? But anyway, Diane, I always love your company, and I can't congratulate you enough on this. And I did mention that you have a very serious previous life as a sommelier.
Right.
Everybody in the wine industry would hire you tomorrow, but you decided to do this, and you know what? God love you. Just God love you.
Well, you know what, Tom? I might put myself with a chef up on your and see if I can auction us off to go to someone's house for a stop dinner. Maybe that's
I'll tell you what, we have a few one percenters. You provide the one. Actually, one of the guys who came on, he was a guest. He's a fine dining and other kind of chef. That's what he's doing for people. He's doing private parties from the food side. You can only imagine.
Maybe we should get together. We could do something.
God. Yeah, but you couldn't invite anybody I know. We wouldn't belong there. We'd be like the riff and the raff. The guys like Flanagan. John, we wouldn't be invited to our own party. Diane, you take care of yourself. We're going to try and smoke this out as best we can. I'd love to have you back as this thing keeps... So you're talking only a year of construction, eh? That's pretty good.
Right, yeah. So let me know. Maybe in July we have the topping off ceremony or something.
That'd be perfect.
Maybe I'll get one of you guys up there. You can... firsthand, check it out. So
all right,
thank you so
do.
Much for your time.
All right, hope to see you soon. SP Futures right. down 18, NASDAQ Futures down 92. Be right back with John. John, you can give me a critique of this whole thing, but that's pretty fascinating stuff. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Best of luck, Diane.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. At PTI, we have always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, North Bay Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 17. NASDAQ Futures down 90. By the way, Andrew, nice job having the two people on at the same time. Diane was loud and clear, and so was Jen. So good work on your part. Dow down 78 bucks. we're tentative here this morning. We're coming back a little bit from the lows, but we're down so much yesterday, and we're trying to get some good news out of this Fed decision. 10 years actually coming back a little bit today. It was up almost over 4.7 yesterday, and it's retreating just a little bit. So that's got to be creating a little bit of less stress for the market here. The DAX down 186. That's a full 1%. FTSE, however, has been kind of off the reservation on the other two lately. Today it's down 45 cents. Let's call that one flat. CAC around down 80. It's a full 1%. So Wait a minute. DAX and CAC around are closed. The FTSE is the only one that's open. So there, sorry about that. So the FTSE is the only one open, and they're flat. Over in Asia, everybody's open here. Nikkei down 131.4%. Hang Seng up 15. Actually, they are not open. Neither is Shanghai. So they're closed, but the Nikkei is open, minus 131. It's all for May Day. We'll have to figure out what Flanagan's doing on May Day. He's all demonstrating someplace. Bonds, 10-year, like I said, down 3 basis points, 4.66. The Bund unchanged, 2.58. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.89. We've got oil down $1.37, so it's almost back to 80 or 80.56. I wonder if my gas is going to go down to 15 cents. It was up last week. I doubt it. Brent down $1.25, 85.08. Natural gas down 5 cents, 193, back under 2 bucks. RBOB down 3 cents, 265. Gold, which got clobbered yesterday, is creeping back up today, up 320, 2306, so maintaining over 2300, at least for the time being. Silver up 8 cents. It was down like a dollar yesterday, 26.84. Everything got creamed yesterday, and we're tentatively sneaking back here. Copper down 2 cents, 454. We got crypto, it got mashed yesterday, and it's down another 1,600 today. 58,173. That's a long way from the 73 top of a few weeks ago. Ouch, ouch. All along the board. Andrew, what do you got for us, Travis Weather Sports?
All right. It is 7:33 here in Chicago, Wednesday, May 1st. Starting off with just a little bit of sports, some baseball here. Cubs lost to the Mets 2-4. White Sox also lost to the Twins 6-5. But the Diamondbacks won over the Dodgers 3-4. Over to Chicago weather, it's currently 66 degrees. We're going to have pretty sunny skies today. A lot of humidity throughout the day, though. It's going to be that uncomfortable kind of warmth. But we're going to have a high of 70. That's going to hit around 2 p.m., and that's going to stick nearly all the way to about 8 p.m. today. Over in Phoenix, they are currently at 67 degrees. They have clear skies. They're going to have a high of 91. That's going to hit around 3 p.m. and stick till about 6 p.m. Now, finally, for Chicago traffic, looks like we got a lot of red on the inbound today. Looks like an accident over on the Eisenhower. That's on the outbound on the right shoulder just before Des Plaines Avenue. Expecting delays up to 20 minutes over there. And looks like there's an accident right over on the right shoulder of the Kennedy. And that's on the Kennedy right before I-94. Also expecting delays up to 20 minutes. But other than that, yeah, things are looking a little bit slow if you're on the inbound. Pretty good if you're on the outbound.
Thursday is the new Friday. It's a big day.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Even though today's only Wednesday. But Wednesday and Thursday are the big days.
Yeah, you had me confused for a second. I was like, well, is it Thursday already?
I wonder if I could throw you off there. Now, Flanagan probably already thinks it's Thursday. John, by the way, thank you for helping out with that's quite a story, isn't it? I mean, it's just one of a really lot of stories that go on with taking care of people after stuff happens. And some people do it and dive in. Other people, you know, are unaware. Other people are aware but ignore it. I mean, and some people decide to help out, and Diane's one of those people. And
well, thanks for the invitation, Tom. But what I was thinking too, while Diane was speaking, that you know, the advantages for families who are there, even if it's for a couple overnight stays, but the opportunity to meet with other families who are there for the exact same reason, for what, you know, whatever injury or whatever episode, you know, military or civilian, that brings them there. I think that's got to have such a therapeutic effect to be able to talk to other people. It's difficult to do that in a hospital, just if you're visiting, and to have that with people who are going through their own heartache. But when you got some time to yourself, when you're staying at a place that's devoted to this purpose, I think it's got to really help people mentally and socially to deal with what they've got on their plate, to hear what other people are going through as well, not just their respective patients, but the people who are coping with the absence of this person, or the financial stress, or whatever. I think it's just, you know, got a tremendously beneficial effect for everyone concerned.
Well, one of the things that, if we had to do the the COVID piece all over again. I think people have to, a lot of bad stuff happens in life, it seems, and there's no seeming like it's random. Good, you know, bad things happen to good people. Sometimes good things happen to good people, but it seems like the one mistake that was really made is the people making the decisions didn't realize how important it is for human beings, almost like puppies. You got to be around other people. And I have to believe that the 2 to 3 or whatever weeks the family spend here, and some of the conversations over the coffee machine and the cookie tray are so helpful to those families, just because you're not by yourself. You get a chance to talk, maybe talk some interesting stories from different people, different walks of life, commiserate. Maybe you find out you're even though you've been dealt a cruel blow, you're not the only one. You have somebody with you. I mean, this stuff is real important. The older you get, the more you realize how important it is. You know, families, even if you get together once a week or twice a week, even if you fight half the time, it doesn't matter. You're still better off than you are sitting in your room by yourself. I mean, it seemed like whoever was in charge during the COVID situation kind of missed all that. They really underestimated how much damage you were going to do to kids growing up if you're sitting home alone by yourself. Nobody liked sitting in fourth grade learning how to diagram sentences, but that's where everybody was in school. That's where he wanted to be, right? I mean, that's where you met the guys after school on the way home, and you already had the football or baseball game. All right, we'll meet you over here in 15 minutes. Bring your stuff, you know. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like learning from home or something. My mom teaching me all day. As much as I hated in fourth grade Mrs. Prendergast, I remember to this day, God, I hated diagramming sentences. But you know what? I can write pretty good, and part of it's because of that, I think.
However you come to the knowledge you get about, you know, grammar or anything else, you know, it's good. There clearly has been a gap teaching that overall. But, you know, what you say about, you know, kids in school is so critical. And you and Kevin were speaking about this earlier. I think, you know, if you were a kid back when we were, at the idea, oh, I can stay home today, well, that would have been okay to a point. But if everybody else that you knew was still in school and you weren't, that was no fun. So the horrible thing about COVID was, you know, you had to be home and you couldn't socialize with anybody.
Right.
Everybody else was too, but you were completely barred from, you know, seeing them face to face or you know, speaking to them without a mask on, so nobody knew what you were saying. And I thought, well, where is the, you know, the downfall in that, unless we really take a long look at what happened by those horrible decisions and find, you know, the process by which those decisions were made, who was really accountable for them, and make sure we never do them again. If we don't do that, you know, we clearly will make those same mistakes.
Well, we not only screwed everybody else, the people who really need protecting, the people in the hospital and the nursing homes, we didn't protect them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insanity. I mean, the people like me who caught it at a hospital, with a mask on, like, I'm pretty sure that's where I caught it. After a week, John, I had actually a mild case, and to the point where I didn't even know I had it, because I had some other problems at the time. And so I actually went to my doctor, and I said, hey, give me the antibody test. I want to make sure I have it. He goes, all right. He wasn't real thrilled about it. He take a bunch of blood, and 3 days later, he goes, oh, you had it. Antibodies are blinking away. John, I was perfectly capable of going and working in a nursing home. I was no threat to anybody. I wouldn't have to wear a mask. I could have gone to work. I could have gone anywhere. Yet there was never any attempt to even farm the people who already had it and say, well, you can go back to work. You can go teach at a school. There was no common sense anywhere. I mean, at least if there was a huge outbreak with measles and you got it, well, then you're not, a week later, you're no danger to anybody. You're the guy you want in the middle of the measles group, right? You can't give it to anybody. And you can't get it again. Yet in this COVID thing, we were in denial on that the whole way. I mean, we went to dinner. A place was supposed to be, you know, supposed to be closed, right? Well, of course it wasn't. They moved the tables a little further apart, but the bar was, you know, butt to elbow. The guys are at the next table. They're going, I work with people all week. I have a job. You know, I'm a contractor. I've already had it. So is my whole family. We're telling me I can't go out to dinner. What's the matter with them? Yet on Tuesday I'm supposed to be out doing stuff with people. It's like, okay, you had to stay home, but the bus driver still had to work. The mailman still had to work. We didn't care about him. I mean, the whole thing was so screwed up, I can't even. The decisions were, obviously, when it first hit, people were pretty afraid. I don't dispute the first 2 weeks or the first month decision, but once things started to become somewhat obvious, they needed to change back pretty quick, I think, and then it became all political. And ugh. Anyway, Jan, we got the Fed meeting today. We've got these numbers coming around. We have a lot of people. I know you're not Mr. Market guy, but this view that somehow or another, no matter where this stuff goes, no matter how much interest it has to get people getting paid and all those kind of things, that nothing's going to change. I don't even want to hear it. You know, I just don't want people that have done well the whole way and maybe intelligently moved their money all in the market and away from fixed income, even though that's probably where they shouldn't have been on the risk curve, and got away with it. I just wish there was a realization that I got away with it. Now it's time to come back at least a little bit, because, by the way, fixed income's back. I'm making something on it. It's not ideal, but I'm making something that instead of being, you know, 95.5 at age 80, I should be, you know, 70.30 or 80.20. I mean, I'm not going to say, I'm never going to give a number out unless I know the person, but suffice it to say, a retired person at age 80 historically would not be considered the person that would be 95% in high tech, even though it's worked for you. I'm just saying, John, historically, nobody in the investment advisor business would say that if you gave it to them on a piece of paper or on a test. Gee, here's Uncle Joe. He's 80. He's got a bunch of high tech stocks. He's worth $1 million. Should he stay 95% invested in high tech? I don't think anybody would say. You at least ought to talk to Uncle Joe and say maybe cut back a little bit. But again, the stocks he's in and the person he is, all is part of it. You don't want to. But I don't see anything like that, John. Everybody's just this movie's going to go forever. We just keep replaying it. I've been here a long time. Whatever movie it is, the movie changes sometimes.
Well, and everybody's is playing catch up. You know, no matter what, Tom. I don't know how you know, for example, can advise somebody and let them hear what they want to hear when you've got inflation eating at every corner of somebody's household economy, such that you can't really, you know, find investments that can trump it and you'll give you something like what you expect to have for, you know, whatever retirement date you're working with, or, you know, your life expectancy or your career path or whatever. I think everybody now is playing a game where they're losing no matter what their investment portfolio looks like, as long as we've got an inflation that doesn't seem to be slackening enough to make it worthwhile to be in, you know, well, even a high yield savings account of some kind. What do you make, 5-6%? Well, you know, inflation is eating that.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, John, for a period of however many years, where you're getting nothing, you know, 1%, even in a 10-year, for God's sake. And inflation, I'm going to say, all those years where they told you it was none, it was around 4, 4.5, maybe 5. If you had an honest shot at what the medical stuff is. Now, if you've been somebody who's been remarkably healthy for the last 20 years, even though it's coming out of your paycheck, what your company's paying, you don't really notice it. You know, you don't have a kid that, or you didn't break a finger playing softball. So, I mean, if you're not exposed to it, you don't know about it. I mean, if you didn't need a new water heater or a new roof, you'd have no idea how much they've gone up. But for a period of time, I'm going to say in, where are we, 2024? If in 2016 you put, or 17, you put money in the bank, $1 million, and it's, and now you made maybe $50,000 total in interest, maybe. I'm going to say that $1 million is worth lower than 700. That there's been at least a 30% inflation over those 8 or 9 years. Now, I mean, we have an awful lot of people here at PTI that they've got a lot of cash, and we're putting the extra cash in 30, 60. 6 month T-bills, and we're getting 5.5. Now, is that spectacular? No, but it's at least the holding pattern at 5.5 is probably close to the inflation number. Maybe it's even a little better. So for the first time in damn near a decade, on risk-free stuff, you're at least staying even. You know, but,
which is something. Yeah,
which is a huge step in the right direction. At least if I put, you know, if you were a client here and we had an extra $300,000 and you go, I don't know if I really want to put it in the market right today, and we put it in a T-bill for 3 months, I'm not hurting you. You know, I mean, I don't think the inflation, if it's a little over 5, it's not much. You know, now the price level of the last 3 or 4 years, now that's another story. I mean, I can't make that back for you. But I mean, I have no problems. And if somebody wants to go to 50% invested, fine. I mean, that's what I say in my commercial. Everybody's themselves. Everybody's unique. There are people who, you know, maybe they got a job. They're making a boatload of dough. They want to find the next stock that's going to triple in the next year. Well, I wish I could always find that one for them. But whatever it is, that's a different playing field, right? But that's not. You know, everybody's different. You know, some people have estate issues. Some people got tax issues. Some people have stock that they've owned forever and their basis is $5 and the thing's trading 200. Well, you got to be careful what you sell there. I mean, it's every single account is different. And, you know, so, I mean, and everybody is locked into this just be all in kind of thing. And I hope it works out for them, Jen. I've seen it turn. I did a room, if I told you this, my buddy Dr. J, I can always count on Jen to do stuff, right? And I love him, but we go to New York. First of all, I'm wondering why I'm invited, right? I had to go see a couple clients, and he was going to do something. He says to me on the plane on the way out there, hey, you know, I got this a seminar I'm giving in Brooklyn tomorrow morning at like 7. Right away, I feel a rat sneaking up my leg, right? Oh, yeah? What's that like got to do with me? Well, you know, it looks like I'm double booked. how about you showed up and covering this thing for me? And I go, well, how the hell do I get to Brooklyn? Well, there's a subway. Okay, then. So there I am, 5:30 in New York, down in the subway. Turns out I was in Brooklyn like in 10 minutes. I mean, you're right there. I mean, so I'm there early, and there's this class. And it was right after the 2000 fiasco, where Cisco went to like $65, and it's now trading like 6, right? And everybody, the whole country was kind of long Cisco and Oracle and those things. Those were the NVIDIAs and the Metas of today. It was Oracle, Cisco, Microsoft was one of them, Intel, Dell was maybe the other one, and those were the go-to stocks. They were, those 5-6 stocks were 45-50% of the NASDAQ, just like the big ones are now. So I get into this morose group of New York Brooklynites, or whatever the hell they are, and the seminar was to talk about repair strategies, which, you know, we're pretty good at. One of these days, if anyone wants, I'll talk about what a repair strategy is. Maybe I'll make you sit through that. It only take me a minute or two, but it's not a hard strategy. So I go, the guy starts the seminar, and everybody was so grumpy, he left. He turned it over to me. He says, you see if you can do something, when he walks out. He's the guy who was in his seminar. So I walk up, and I go, well, why is everybody here? You're supposed to teach us repair strategies. Okay, that I can do. By the way, what are we talking about repairing? And one guy goes, I got all this Cisco stock. And I said, okay, it's from down to 60 down to 6. That's kind of a hell of a repair. I don't know if I have a formula for that one necessarily. That's a stretch. I don't know. Harry Houdini can come up with one there. So I said, okay, how many people in the room have Cisco stock? John, there's like 40 people. There are like 38 hands one of them. And they wrote it all the way up and all the way down. I mean, I don't know where the average price everybody bought it, but, you know, they probably bought some at 10, some at 20, some at 30, and, you know, averaged their way up or down or whatever, and now everybody's sitting there clunked. And you just can't let that happen. I mean, and, you know, somewhere along the way, you got to say it's not as good a buy as it was cheaper, and even though, or simply put, If 1,000 shares of Cisco at $10 was right for your portfolio, when it went to $20, it's now too big for your portfolio if you want to be diversified. But the hardest thing to tell somebody, and start at the beginning here, Jen, if you plunk $1 million down and you don't want to be in any indexes, which makes it a lot easier now, or different, meant so much easier. If you say, I want to put $50,000 into 20 different stocks, we're going to have a balanced portfolio. So we sit down, and you know, I'm not the world's greatest on this stuff, but maybe we grab Barron's, we do something, and we pick 20 stocks. Maybe 10 of them are the ones you like, or 10 or 12, and I just suggest complementary industries to the ones you like, which I could do that. You know, I sound like I'm a dummy when it comes to stocks. I just realize, Jen, that it's very difficult for somebody to tell you or me a stock's going up or down the next day. I mean, as a guy who spent the, you know, 20 years on the trading floor, picking that every morning is a zero-sum game. Anyway.
You know, and I guess, you know, you realize that, you know, this is, you need to liquidate something in your portfolio, and then you're going to take the hit for it. You can stay with a stock even if it's declining, because it's, you know, you haven't felt the effect of that decline until you convert it to something else, and then you realize your buying power is reduced. I'm looking at things like the real estate mess, where you've got banks that, you know, for a while have had mortgages on properties that were declining in value, you know, commercial properties, and it didn't make much difference as long as they had some kind of performance on those loans and they weren't stuck holding the bag.
The difference, John, is they're not, the term is mark to market. Nobody's marking them to market. If you buy IBM today at 166, and, you know, I'm not saying this will happen or even predicting it, if tomorrow morning it's 160, everybody knows you're down six. I mean, it's marked to market. The real estate, like you're talking about, even like the federal bonds that the banks own, if you bought a place, and I did, for $100 million 5 years ago, and we know it's only worth 70, we're not taking the $30 million hit on our income statement.
Right. No, but I mean, in like the case of the 216 West Jackson building, the lender took title to the property, auctioned it off to get it off their books, and, you know, took a, you know, reduction from $16 million that they had in equity down to $2 million, which is what the auction price was.
Right.
So that's the $14 million hit right off the bat. Yeah, they don't have the property anymore. They don't have the $14 million bucks either. So that's all a realized loss now. And I see it's something like the same thing happening with a property owner. The fact that your property may be declining in value doesn't really mean very much as a homeowner until you go to sell, you're trying to trade or do something with that asset. But if all of a sudden you get, you know, an insurance premium this year that's twice what last year's was, or your tax bill shoots way up, that's taking money out of your disposable income and immediately, you know, causing an impact in your household finances because of what's going on with this property. And exclusive of what the value thing is, the cost of maintaining it or hanging on to it and preventing the loss of it is not something you ever really considered, or at least didn't consider rising as fast as it has. So you got some shock in you know, the real estate market, whether commercial or residential, of people all of a sudden getting a wake-up call about what they've really bought into with this thing, and it's making some of their investments untenable.
Well, John, I'm going to explain it a little different, because this is now, you know, the way I always talk. Now, this is going to be blasphemy to myself here. The difference is, if it's your home, other than maybe an automobile or something, it's probably the only good that you can, only good that's, it's two things. It's an investment good and it's a consumption good. Where most other stuff are one or the other. Just about all other stuff. So in other words, if I buy IBM at 100 and it goes to 160, it goes back to 100 and I didn't sell it, it's totally an investment good. I essentially lost an opportunity cost of $60. Okay, I was up 60 and I didn't take the up, and now I'm down 60. I didn't take that. I'm kind of right back where I started from. But now in your house, it's a little different, because people in their house, most people live there. Now, if you start having more than one house, now this whole conversation changes. But if it's one house and you buy it at 300, and somewhere along the line you could have sold it at 500 and you didn't, and all of a sudden the market crashes a little bit and it's 400. Unless you're going to sell it at 500, plunk your behind in a little motel for 2 years waiting for the prices to come down and throw a quarter into the little massage thing every night in the bed, like, nobody does that. I mean, a few people might I got to believe if you're married and a couple of kids, you come home with that idea, you're eating a frying pan upside the head. Right, it's just not what families do. But now for you, the fact that you could have sold it at five and you didn't at four, and now the kids leave home and the place is too big for you and the wife, and you sell it at $4 million and you go buy a townhome, you sort of haven't lost anything because the townhome is now down the same amount. Because really what you're doing is you're trading at that level. It's a little different, but it's only regarding houses. It's not. But if now you go to a second house, now that's a whole different story, right? Because on a second house, it's totally an investment.
You know, the thing for me is when the house no longer becomes affordable, where it always looked affordable, and there's been an unforeseen or unforeseeable jump in expenses associated with owning this asset that you didn't consider, and you never would have undertaken the purchase if you had known at the time what you realize now. So you either have to dump the asset, or stop eating for a week to pay your tax bill. I mean, the choices are ridiculous and horrendous and painful. And even if you can sell this place and not lose a ton of money on it, what are you going to do then to replace it? You're going to be paying through the nose somewhere else for having less house, and paying more for it in every way, not just in the interest rate, but in the insurance and taxes, just like the things that drove you out of the place that you couldn't hang on to already. So I see that there's a kind of, class of assets that are becoming like stink bombs. Nobody's.
Well, but Jen, what you're describing is, unless you're in my industry, or actually, kind of what you did for a living, most people look at the price of the house and they look at the price. Okay, but the real number is, how much can the person, couple, whoever the hell is going to live there, what's the total nut per month is what you're talking about. And so it has to do with, this couple can afford $3,000 a month. All right, well now, given the state of the interest rates, all right, whatever they happen to be at the time, that gives them a number. Okay, so it's 7%. It means they can afford a $350,000 house, whatever it is. Nancy's here; she can do it off the top of her head. But now all of a sudden, I got to pay these nasty things like taxes and insurance. Generally, are sort of even Steven along most areas, but they're not all the time. I mean, Audrey tells you about places down south where the house may lure you in, and then all of a sudden the taxes are $1,500 a month, and they're more than your mortgage. So all of a sudden, these things can be outside shocks. I mean, obviously, what Dan Janias was talking about last week is the insurance in Florida is now an outside shock to the point where people are puking these things out 20% less than they paid for them, and they're happy to get out of there because the insurance costs they can't. Scenario,
they're not even offering insurance, in which case the house is effectively valueless in the event you're wiped out.
Yeah. Well, but the condo places are somehow paying up and just sending you the bill. I mean, I didn't realize there are places where no number gets you insurance. I mean, I guess
in California. I mean, I think this is the problem with I mean, California is an example of a very poorly run state from the get go. Florida, you wouldn't think so, but it's beset by problems that due to its increasing population and its exposure as a result to storms, floods, and so on, that were less of a disaster when you had fewer people living there, and now so many more people are in the path of things like this. I can see why insurance companies might just decline to insure.
Well, John, let's talk about this. Scribble it down because you're better keeping notes. Let's talk about it Monday because I'm curious in places, and I'll use Houston as an example where they had all that rain and all those houses got flooded out that I'm not sure, but I'm 99% sure we're not technically in a flood plain. Now, if Texas or the city of Houston went back and redid the 100-year storm stuff, if all those houses now are, quote, in a flood plain, I could see maybe where they absolutely can't get insurance. I mean, there's got to be places everywhere where we didn't think this was a flood plain, but now it is. Let's talk about that on Monday because that's a fascinating subject. Andrew, thank you again. SP Futures down 12. We're coming back. NASDAQ Futures down 66. Maybe we'll get back to even by the time the Fed speaks. We'll see. And then after they do it, then the gloves are off. And we'll talk about it tomorrow morning in Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit Nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. Dax Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
That's all, folks.